no. Likely not when they are in the height of a psychotic episode. Maybe in between, but certainly the symptoms of psychosis are not that amenable to talk therapy or changes through talk therapy. So chances are we are looking at, for sure, medications. And our class of meds are antipsychotics. Neuroleptics is more or less synonymous. It's an older term. And then our major tranquilizers is even yet an older term to refer to antipsychotics. Important to note, though, if they're considered major tranquilizers, what do? Tranquilize, they sedate. And that's why oftentimes if you see someone out of control, agitated, they will inject someone with an antipsychotic. And it's not going to cure their hallucinations and delusions right away, but it will tranquilize them. It does sedate them. It's still being used for that major tranquilizing purpose, even if it's not affecting their hallucinations or delusions, it's certainly sedating them. Now, all of our antipsychotics share in common the fact that they block dopamine and, in particular, the D2 receptor. Some of our antipsychotics block the D2 receptor more potently than others. Other antipsychotics do D2 plus other receptors of dopamine. But the commonality across all antipsychotics is D2 blockade. Our original, what we call our first generation antipsychotics, our traditional antipsychotics, Haldol and chlorpromazine being our two representative ones. Chlorpromazine, famous because it was really our first major drug that we used to try to treat mental illness. So it gets a lot of publicity. It's still used, but not as commonly. And Haldol still used as well today. These are more potent dopamine receptor blockers. The problem is that as much as we want to block dopamine where? Where do we want to block dopamine? We want to block dopamine mesolimbically. But the problem is these are potent dopamine blockers and they're blocking dopamine in our nigrostriatal motor system. That means side effects are going to be notable in the motor domain. And that's one of the biggest criticisms of these drugs is that you get a lot of extrapyramidal symptoms. Now, also note that as much as these drugs may help voices and their delusions, these first generation drugs don't tend to do much for the negative symptoms. And this is a problem because, yes, we're happier that the voices are a little quieter. We're happier that you're not so delusional. You can admit that maybe you're wrong and their thinking is more logical and linear. But if you are still like that patient you saw in the video who is sitting on a couch not doing his laundry, not cashing his disability checks, not doing anything, you still have a very disabled person, even though they're not as floridly psychotic. So a disadvantage of these is that it doesn't necessarily help the negative symptoms. And if that's a big part of your picture, then you're not treating the whole symptom package. Now, as far as our EPS goes, we have several forms of extrapyramidal symptoms. One is the dystonic reaction. And the dystonic reaction is a muscle contraction, but it's sustained. So in this case, this guy's mouth is kind of stuck open. Imagine turning your neck as if you're looking at your neighbor and then getting stuck in that posture. So it's called torticollis. Imagine grimacing and getting stuck in your grimace. Okay, it's not rhythmic, it's sustained. Or a sneer. I was, by my brothers, told I was queen sneer. I could sneer anyone down. But imagine sneering and being stuck in that posture, having that muscle contraction sustained. That is a dystonic reaction. If you're going to have a dystonic reaction to an antipsychotic, it usually manifests fairly soon after you take the drug. It's usually not a long-term manifestation. Parkinsonism can be induced from our antipsychotics, so we're going to look like we're 50, 60 years old with Parkinson's disease, with shuffling gait, the tremor, the rigidity, the masked faces. They call it the Haldol shuffle. That's kind of the colloquialism for it because these drugs classically cause this Parkinsonism. Another form of EPS, akathisia, might be a new term for you. This is this motor restlessness. They have to move around. They got to move their legs up, down. They can't sit still. And they just say, this is so uncomfortable. I got to move. If you're not aware of this possible symptom, then doctors, nurses often think that this just means they're getting more agitated. And if the psychotic person, the schizophrenic, is getting more agitated, what do? We use our tranquilizers. We add more antipsychotic in to calm them down. And that's not helping matters. And you think, is this a bad experience? Is this uncomfortable? And when you ask the patients about it, they say, I'd rather hear the demeaning voices. I'd rather be harassed and tormented by voices than experience this restlessness. And I never thought that it could be that uncomfortable, but the report is it is very, very uncomfortable. In fact, some people, there's been cases supposedly where when the patient didn't recognize that this was a side effect of meds that can be treated, that they have actually killed themselves because they thought that this was going to be their life from then on. So it was a catalyst for suicidal actions. So just trying to emphasize, akathisia sounds like such a minor problem, but on the other hand, its experience is very, very uncomfortable. TD, tardive dyskinesia. This is typically what you see after several years of being on a drug, not usually short-term side effect. So when you see someone with these rhythmic, repetitive motor actions, like your tongue protruding over and over again, that usually means they've been on an antipsychotic a while, usually years. Some people have more, like imagine chewing gum. But you're not chewing gum, but you're doing, or lip smacking. So again, this repetitive, involuntary, rhythmic type of movement that manifests, often orally, buccofacially, but off and distally as well. But it's a long-term phenomenon. Yes? Choreiform, I think, are more dance-likey. This is more rhythmic. If that helps. NMS is another possibility. This is potentially fatal. Usually someone would wind up in the emergency room because they have just become obtunded, that their mental status, they're just confused, bewildered, more than just being schizophrenic, but just absolutely sort of glazed over, almost catatonic. And you're not a catatonic schizophrenic, but you look catatonic, and in addition to being rigid and non-responsive, that you've got high fever and you've got blood pressure up and down, you've got basically autonomic instability on top of being catatonic. So this is something that we have to be concerned about, usually manifests fairly early after you've put someone on a drug or just maybe titrated their dose up, but it's a huge reaction to having this drug in the system. And so it's thought to not just affect the motor system with your sort of catatonic reaction, but also thought to be affecting hypothalamic functioning and sort of knocking you out of homeostasis. But it is a potentially lethal situation. Not just caused by our antipsychotics, but antipsychotics are most likely to produce this. Then we have the next wave, the second generation of antipsychotics called atypicals. Now, our atypicals, the first one of this class was Clozaril. I remember when it was marketed and it was going to be the new wonder drug for schizophrenia. And in reality, it probably is the single antipsychotic drug that shows better effectiveness than the others. And usually there's not a whole lot of difference in how effective they are, but Clozaril is probably the better one, but we don't use it first line because it is associated with this dramatic drop in white blood cell count. Not in everyone, but 1 or 2% of the population that take this drug would experience this, and this is basically putting you in a very immunocompromised state. So if you actually take this drug because nothing else is working for you, then you've got to be monitored pretty much weekly for your white blood cell count. So it can be used and it can be effective, but just not first line. In general, though, this class of antipsychotic works a little bit differently. It does block dopamine and the D2 receptor, but it blocks other receptors. And in addition, there is some serotonergic blockade. So this different approach of blocking dopamine and more diffusely, more different types of receptors, and adding in the serotonergic blockade, for some reason still not quite known, tends to help the positive symptoms, like our old drugs, but also helps our negative symptoms a little bit more. At least in theory, that was supposed to be the case. And because of the the way that it's blocking dopamine is thought to be more specific to the schizophrenic tracts and not the motor system. So we're not supposed to be blocking dopamine as much in the motor pathways. So therefore, less risk in theory of EPS. So advantages of atypical, it's helping the bigger package of both positive and negative symptoms. But at the same time, once again, theoretically, thought to not cause the extrapyramidal symptoms as much as the first generations. Still not a cure, still not complete remission, but it's likely the drugs that we're going to try first for schizophrenia. Now, in addition to motor side effects, antipsychotics do have some other side effects that prevent people from wanting to take them. They don't want to take them long term because of motor side effects. They don't want to take them because in 3 months I just put on 20 pounds, and they don't want to take it because of that. They don't like the zombie feeling that they have when they're taking it, and they might not like the fact that they can't have erections and they don't have orgasm, and it can interfere with their sexual responsiveness. So antipsychotics are a lot of different problems with their administration. So keeping someone on their meds long term, just as an example, this was one who stopped taking his drugs because it wasn't so much side effects as it was, well, I'm living on an island where my antipsychotic's not readily available, so let me half my dose so it'll last twice as long. And then the problem became that as he started taking a sub-threshold dose that wasn't helping him, then the voices came back more full force, and the delusional beliefs came back full force. And he started to believe, without a doubt, that forces were taking the meds from his esophagus, and the drug wasn't getting into his system, therefore why take the pill even at all? So then he stopped even taking any pill, not even half his dose, because of his belief. Okay, so many things can interfere with someone's ability to take their drug reliably. Some of his side effects, some of it's financial, some of it is just the nature of the disorder, their paranoia. What other things can we do besides throw someone on an antipsychotic? Well, if you can get them a job, get them stable enough where they can do something, that is going to be important, obviously, for self-worth and other important self-esteem issues, is get them connected as much as possible if they are functional enough. And I've worked with a few faculty members over the years that we didn't know were schizophrenic when we hired them, but it came out during the course of their teaching. And they were brilliant people. They were good professors when they weren't psychotic, but when they had their psychotic episode, then there was no reasoning with them. But in between the psychotic episodes, they were certainly amenable to talking to someone about the disorder they had and working on strategies for reducing stress and keeping out of in situations that might promote a psychotic episode. So psychotherapy is not ruled out, but it's probably not great in the time you're in a psychotic episode. And then families usually are involved because they are the ones helping the person in and out of hospitals, likely financially supporting the person, and helping them deal with the optimal environment to help their child. Could you use ECT, like for mood disorders? You could, but chances are meds, you've got a much greater chance that meds are going to work. ECT you usually don't think about unless meds aren't working and we don't have any other options. And in particular, if you're the catatonic type, like with the catatonic depression, might respond a little bit better to ECT if it's not responding to the medications. So what about lobotomy? Don't we do lobotomy? We talked about ECT. We said ECT is used, despite the fact that everyone's scared of ECT. It is used, and it's safe and effective. Lobotomy, that is truly past. That is days gone by, but it is part of our history of treating schizophrenics, and it was a surgery approach where they would drill holes in the skull, and then at first they poured alcohol down the holes, then they changed to just getting a leukotome and just slicing away haphazardly. They did this on chimpanzees first, thought they had good effects, and then they moved to humans, and we did this for many years and with many thousands of people. Egas Moni, in fact, was the one that first did it in humans after he saw the chimpanzee data. He won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for this. And a lot of people today, contemporaneously, are saying, oh, that's horrible. We want to revoke it. They wanted, there's movement to revoke it. It's not going to be done, but they want to revoke it. But it tells you at the time, we didn't have a great way of dealing with schizophrenia. We didn't have medications at the time. We didn't know how to deal with people with these type of behaviors, and the scientific method clearly wasn't utilized to make sure that this was actually effective. Now, Walter Freeman gets the notoriety of basically using this in the States and becoming, well, a little too fervent about it, a little too evangelistic about it. He thought everyone should get it. Bored housewife, come on in. And he would actually do this as an outpatient procedure. Just say, just put on sunglasses, hide your eyes, because he refined the technique and said, who needs big holes in the cranium? Let's go through a natural hole, the orbit. And so he stuck leucotomes through the orbit. And this is a simulation. It's him talking, Walter Freeman. It is not a person, but it's demonstrating the technique.
In this cadaver study, the leucotome is driven through the orbital plate parallel with the bony ridge of the nose, and cuts are made at 5 and 7 centimeters, followed by the deep frontal cut. For purposes of brevity, this scene is speeded up. The procedure is repeated on the opposite side. 5 centimeters. 7 centimeters.
Hey, just put on your sunglasses and you go home the same day. I mean, really, he just turned it into, and he did. He went around the United States. He was performing them, teaching nurses how to do them. He was really, really enthusiastic about this technique, despite the fact we didn't have data that really showed it was effective. There were some case reports that said, oh, this person was out of control and now they just lay there. Well, yeah, they lay there because you just damage their frontal lobe, damage all their initiative, damage everything. So we are actually pretty embarrassed about this in the world of psychiatry, is that we did this to many thousands of people. But it was sort of the sign of the times, how desperate people were to try to control behavior we didn't understand. And then chlorpromazine enters the scene, Thorazine. And now all of a sudden, oh, we can control behavior maybe with meds and not through any sort of lobotomy technique. Do we still do psychosurgery at all? Do we go in and deliberately damage the brain for any disorder? We do. And this week, we're going to be talking about obsessive compulsive disorder. And we go in extreme cases, and we do damage part of the brain deliberately. But it's millimeters in size, not just haphazardly slicing the connections of the brain. So we do psychosurgery, just not for schizophrenia. So let's talk about some other possible diagnoses. So schizophrenia very thoroughly. These are on the spectrum, so there's going to be some commonalities. We don't know as much about, we don't research them as much, but the thought is it's similar to schizophrenia etiology. But in the case of schizophreniform disorder, this person has an active phase. They have the 1 month, at least, of two symptoms. One has to be core. But what makes this different? It's got to not endure, because if it endures, it's schizophrenia. So this is identical to schizophrenia, but the symptoms resolve in less than 6 months. So it's just a timeline issue. Now, note, if I said they have 3 months worth of symptoms of hallucinations, delusions, they haven't resolved yet, but I still say it's schizophreniform disorder, even if it hasn't resolved. I just keep it that until it either resolves, which I was right, or I'm wrong because it goes to schizophrenia, and I'll just change my diagnosis. But you don't do it provisionally. You just say, if it's 3 months, okay, we're going to call it schizophreniform, and we don't do provisional. We just label it as that and then change it if necessary. Okay, so schizophreniform, schizophrenia is forming, not quite there yet, less than 6 months, but you still have that active phase. Brief psychotic disorder. This requires only one symptom. But it's got to be, I mean, you can have more, but it only requires one, and it's got to be a core. And it is brief, and by brief, they say it's resolved in under a month. So they don't have any active phase. It's just one symptom, less than or at least one symptom, core, under a month. And then they're back to functioning basically how they were before they got ill. This is typically a situation where you see someone that they're under a lot of pressure, you know, good job, maybe highly competitive, fast driving type of law firm, really, and then, you know, workaholic type of person, and then the stress just gets too much and you have this breakdown. And the breakdown could be becoming paranoid, becoming hearing voices. I'm hearing the neighbors talk about me. You can't be hearing the neighbors talk about you. They live a mile away. You cannot hear that far. And they're hearing voices. They end up in the hospital. And then within a week, oftentimes, they're back to baseline, back to go to work. It was a brief reaction. It's just your reaction, your breakdown was in the psychotic realm. And so you often do see a stressor that precipitates it. Things just get overwhelmed, sometimes not. But in this case, brief psychotic, one core required under a month. So what do you think of this person? So what symptoms, once again, to approach these questions, I would want to identify what are my symptoms. Timeline comes later. I have, in this case, hallucinations and delusions. Knowing that I have two symptoms, I ask myself, is one at least core? In fact, both are core. So knowing that I have two symptoms for at least that are, and one of at least is core, then I'm looking at the world of schizophrenia. I'm looking at schizophrenia form. It actually could be brief. It's going to be one of these three based on timeline. Timeline, 2 months. What does that tell you? It's not long enough to be schizophrenic. It's not brief enough to be brief. So it's got to be the intermediate. So it'd be schizophrenia form. So once again, I don't wait until it resolved to prove that I was right. I'm schizophrenia form unless something else changes. I would only do unspecified if I knew for a fact they didn't meet anything. And right now, they are meeting the timeline for schizophrenia form. I might have to change it if the symptoms keep going and going and going. At 6 months, I might have to change my label. But right now, it's schizophrenia form. Ralph? Can you see if Ralph is back there? I'm going to lose my battery very soon, just to let you know. It's just about dead. All right. So for this question, I would ask myself, what symptom do I show? I show hallucinations and hallucinations only. Immediately, what do I rule out? Schizophrenia, because you've got to have at least a period of two. schizophreniform, have to have a period of two, gone. So now I'm left with, is this brief or is it unspecified? Brief requires one core symptom, which it happens to be a positive symptom. And in this case, hallucinations is a core symptom, so it'd be brief. What if I change the scenario? I could make a brand new question with a different answer by saying, same thing, and I change that number from 2 to 6 weeks. It's unspecified because it's still just one symptom. It's core, but it's well past brief. We don't have another name for someone who just hallucinates for a long, long, long time. So in that case, I could change this to unspecified if I made it longer than that brief psychotic disorder timeline. Delusional disorder tells you that their only symptom is a fixed false belief, that they don't have disorganized thinking, they don't have hallucinations, they don't have disorganized behavior, they don't have negative symptoms. And the fact that they don't have these symptoms and only have this fixed false belief that lasts over a month or more, it tells you that they actually functionally are pretty good. Their behavior is goal-directed. They make sense when they talk. They don't hallucinate. They have a belief that's just false. So imagine interviewing them, doing a mental status exam on them, talking to them, interviewing them. They're going to look absolutely normal. They're going to probably evade your detection of anything wrong with them, unless you ask the right question. Do you think anyone's out to get you? Yes. And then they'll tell you about all the people that are out to get them. Do you think someone is cheating on you? Yes. But if you don't ask the right question, they're going to look so absolutely non-psychotic. They're going to look normal. So functionally, they're doing very well. It's just, yes, you're going to have impairment. If you, for example, if you believe that your boss is trying to kill you, then you might not show up to work. There is functional impairment, but it's directly related to your belief. It's not functional impairment because you're disorganized in your thinking or disorganized in your behavior. I mentioned at the beginning that there are a number of adjectives for delusions. DSM recognizes official subtypes. There are many other kinds of delusions, but they recognize these as official subtypes, and anything else we'll just put under some sort of other. So if you have a fixed false belief and you're paranoid, my boss has put a hit out on me, trying to assassinate me, then that is persecutory. If you have that belief that you have invented that aquarium, that fish will live forever and you're going to make millions off this, that's grandiose. You're going to get the grandiose subtype. If you believe without a doubt that someone loves you and this person's basically never even talked to you before, but you're sure that they love you, then you've got the erotomanic type. And the classic scenario for this is that a female takes on the belief that some person, usually of higher status, it's the physician, it's the lawyer, it's the football star, quarterback. Let's say I am a worker in the cafeteria at a hospital, and the physician comes through and he asks for the mashed potatoes and this and that, and I scoop it and he asks for more, I give him more, and then when I take his money and when he hands me change, his hand lingers a little longer than anyone else, and I know for a fact that he loves me and I too love him. And if you ask her, well, why hasn't this guy ever talked to you? Oh, well, he's married with children, and he couldn't dare jeopardize that. But we communicate. I mean, basically, they believe with very little evidence. And if you challenge them, they couldn't risk the wife finding out. Oh, no, he's really busy. You know, he's a physician, and he works long hours. You can't talk him out of it. By definition, it's delusional. So that's the erotomanic type. The jealous type, typically man. Man says, without a doubt, partner's cheating on me. I know for a fact. And that makes him mad. So then he might become, what do you call it, he sequesters his partner. You can't go out. You're basically under lock and key. Or he might become abusive to her or abusive to the people that he thinks she's having an affair with. And he knows for a fact that they're having an affair, that he's, that the partner's having an affair with someone. And then all he's doing is looking for evidence, proving his point. He already knows it, but he's going to prove it to the world. So he is who your Facebook friends, and look at the credit card statement charges, and look in the bed for stains, and look for, I mean, they're just everything. They're so convinced about this. Now think about this. How do you know that that's delusional? If you're interviewing someone and they say, hey, what's going on in your life? Anything, any problems? Yeah, my wife's cheating on me. Would you think that's delusional? You just think, yeah, I mean, this goes on a lot. How would you ever recognize they actually have a psychotic disorder? That one's going to get evade detection, I think, quite a bit. Except when they do something assaultive and then they get taken in, and then the wife's like, you know, able to convince everyone that there's no way she could be having an affair. And then the suspicion is that maybe he's delusional. Other types of subtypes. The somatic type. Officially, this is someone who believes without a doubt that there's something wrong with their body. We mentioned this when we talked about illness, anxiety, disorder differentials. But this is someone who is convinced, I have parasites. I have bug. I have something wrong. Usually it is some sort of parasite, whether it be flukes, you know, tapeworms, lice, mites, whatever you can think of, they're infected, and they know it. And they're bringing in stool samples, and they're bringing in skin samples, and they know for a fact, look at this, look at this. No, that's just normal variation in stool. No, that's just normal skin flecks in your bathwater. That's not, so they're convinced that they've got something wrong with them, that they have a bad odor, or that, you know, their heart doesn't work, and their small intestine doesn't work, but they know for a fact. Okay, this is when we get delusional. So we had mentioned already illness anxiety, not up here, but it should be part of your differential. Illness anxiety, the difference. Illness anxiety might say something's wrong with my heart and you've missed it, versus this one's going to say there is something wrong with my heart and fix it. I want surgery. So one is in delusional disorder, you're 100% convinced you have it. In the illness anxiety or SSD, you worry. But it's not delusional. It's not 100% certain. You just worry too much about it. And then we mentioned body dysmorphic disorder. So with body dysmorphic disorder, we talked about, and we'll talk more about this week, is where someone believes and is worried about a flaw in their appearance. Now, they can be delusional. They can know for a fact that my nose is so hideous that I deserve to die. I'm so ugly because of my huge nose, and your nose is normal in size. You can be delusional with BDD. So it's sort of on that verge of, is this delusional disorder, or is it body dysmorphic disorder with delusions? Well, if it's vanity related, we're sticking it in body dysmorphic. If it's not vanity related, we're going to call it delusional disorder somatic type. What we also can do is specify whether your delusion is bizarre or non-bizarre. How do we know this? A non-bizarre delusion is one that is physically possible. It's plausible. So, for example, my wife is cheating on me. Bizarre or non-bizarre? Non-bizarre. It could happen. Erotomanic delusion. Can someone love me? Yes, that's possible. That is not a bizarre delusion that lawyer or doctor or football player loves me. Someone's trying to kill me. Someone's trying to tap my phone. Someone's spying on me. Someone's put some sort of listening device in my thermostat. I'm ripping apart my thermostat because I know it's in there. Bizarre or non-bizarre? It's non-bizarre. It could happen. That's what most delusions are, non-bizarre. But as soon as you're in the bizarre realm, that's much more significant. So what's something that's just not possible? Well, what's something alien? A lot of alien thoughts or time travel. I can flip back and forth in time. I have no heart. I have no heart in my body at all. My heart is now where my lungs were. My lungs are where my kidneys were. Just things that just physically can't happen. Then you're in the bizarre realm. So you do specify. In most cases, they're going to be non-bizarre. but bizarre isn't just a little bit more notable. You also can have someone who, Duncan is delusional, and he's the persecutory type. So he knows for a fact students are trying to get him fired. You're actively trying to petition to get him gone. I have hung out with him way too long, with no friends, for many, many, many decades. Well, not many, many, but several decades. And I start believing he's right. Duncan, students are trying to get you fired. They are petitioning to get you out of here. Now, in the past, if someone took on the delusion of someone they hang out with too long and in isolation, we actually called that shared psychotic disorder. DSM eliminated that term. If anyone knew that term, it's gone. Now they're saying whether it's your own delusion you came up with or you're sharing someone's delusion, it's still delusional disorder. So it is still now just one diagnosis, delusional disorder. Now, treatment might be a little bit different. If I am believing Duncan, it's almost like brainwashing. Like, I've got no reality testing means other than Duncan, who's psychotic. So, in this example. So, what's the way to treat me? The obvious thing is get some friends of your own, Brenda. Go get engaged in hobbies outside of what he does. Open up yourself to other means of reality testing and not have him be my only source of information, and maybe that brainwashing effect will dissipate. Now, you can imagine if this has happened because of decades of living together, that you're not so open to the idea of just not hanging out together, whether it be being physically separated, I'm going to go live with mom for a while, I'm going to go live with sister for a while. But at the very least, if you can actually get them separated, you try to get that person more hooked up with activities in which they can interface with people who might be a source of reality testing. Some would say it's a psychotic disorder. You're believing without a doubt. Antipsychotics may help with that. It might help loosen and reduce that degree of conviction about your delusion. And the final of the psychotic disorders, which is a little bit confusing, but I hope I've simplified it as much as it can be simplified. So did I skip something? Did we hit it twice? Schizoaffective disorder is saying this. It's got the schizo, so the psychotic element, and the affective, saying the mood problem. It's a disorder that has both the psychosis and the mood problems as big parts of the clinical picture. So I want to emphasize both qualities. So to get this diagnosis, it says that there are periods of time in which I am psychotic. I am psychotic with voices, delusions, and I'm in a mood episode. So concurrently, I'm manic and psychotic or depressed and psychotic, but I've got the concurrent symptoms. Then, even when my mood problem's gone, I'm not manic, I'm not depressed, I still have psychotic symptoms. I'm still delusional. I'm still hallucinating. Otherwise, let's go back to the first symptom. The first symptom says, you're mood disturbed and psychotic. What would you call that if I was depressed and hearing voices? Manic and hearing voices? Let's say MDD with psychotic features. I'd say bipolar 1 with psychotic features. If I only had symptom number 1, I already have a mood disorder that can capture that. But what makes schizoaffective different is that in this case, mood is cleared up. Mood is not a problem, and yet I still have voices. I still am delusional. So a mood disorder can't capture my problem because I'm not even mood disordered at the moment, and I'm still psychotic. So the second symptom is key in the sense there's a period of time with no mood problems, and yet the psychosis persists. Then if we want to say schizoaffective, if we want to say that both types of symptoms are major to your presentation, then time-wise, they both better be significant, proportional, balanced. So this is one way of illustrating this. So just haphazardly, randomly, I said, I'm going to graph anything psychotic above the x-axis, anything mood-wise below the x-axis. I have said that this person, for 8 months, has had both problems. They are depressed and psychotic. Then they are no longer depressed, but but they're hearing voices delusional for another month or so. If I graph this out, it should be more apparent now when you do your symptom checklist. Do you have symptom number one, a period of time when you're mood disordered and psychotic? Yes. Do you have a period of time in which there's no mood problem, but you're still psychotic? Yes. Now, balance, time proportion. You ask yourself, how long have you been mood disturbed? 8 months. How long have you been psychotic? You've been 8 months plus 1 month, 9 months. So you just say eight ninths, that's well over 50%. So you're saying mood is a big part of this problem. Okay, eight ninths. Anything I say over 50%, that's majority of the time, and that would qualify for schizoaffective. All right, so why don't you do this one and see if... So with this scenario, especially when you start hearing mood and psychosis, I start going through my checklist. Do you have a period of time in which mood and psychosis occur together? Yes. Do we have a period of time in which there's no mood problems and you still have psychosis? Yes. So you're almost to the schizoaffective diagnosis, except that schizoaffective said both mood and the psychotic symptoms have to be sort of balanced. They have to be equalish in their presentation. Are you going to pass or fail on that? How long have you been psychotic? 10 years plus. How long have you had your mood problem? 1 month. 1 month to 10 plus years is not proportional by any stretch. So you would fail schizoaffective disorder based on they're not both big parts of your presentation. Psychosis certainly is a huge part of your presentation. Mood is a blip. So schizoaffective fails because they're not sort of equally represented. So you're close, but the proportionality doesn't work in this case. Now, we still have to diagnose the person. What are we going to call them? Her, I should say. Schizophrenia is probably the most obvious. 10 years of hallucinations and delusions are going to give you schizophrenia. Is that all? Normally, I like one diagnosis. But in this case, what are you doing with mania? You can't ignore the fact they just had a manic episode. And this is where you say, it looks like they've got a long-standing history of schizophrenia, but they also, I mean, any person that has a manic episode is bipolar 1. So they have a double diagnosis. So in this case, schizophrenia would probably be what they had most of their life. They have a manic episode. Bipolar 1, we diagnose separately. So again, we know the most about schizophrenia etiology treatments. As far as the other disorders on the spectrum, they're going to obviously share some similarities. We don't know exactly how they differ. But chances are any psychotic disorder is going to be treated with antipsychotics. Regardless of what your specific diagnosis is, you're likely going to be using medications and using other interventions as necessary. Okay. Now, this is your summary chart, trying to highlight the difference between these. Remember schizophrenia, you've got that active phase, but so does schizophreniform. The major difference is how long it persists. Brief psychotic, you don't need an active phase, but you need a core symptom, and it's got to be transient. It's got to resolve in under a month. Delusional disorder. How about this question? I believe without a doubt that football quarterback star loves me. And the football player's like, I don't even know who she is. This has gone on for 2 weeks. What are you going to call me? Brief. And people get old. That's the automatic. That's delusional disorder. Well, only if it lasts long enough. If my delusion doesn't last long enough, I'm brief. I'm brief until it goes on for at least a month, and then you can change it to delusional. And then schizoaffective, be worried about those three major symptoms: concurrent, mood, psychosis, psychosis alone, and then proportionality. All right, have a great afternoon. See you tomorrow.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.